This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Taking a look at the issues surrounding the health and well-being of our LGBTIQ+ communities. This is Well, 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 brought to you by the team from Thorn Harbour Health on Joy and the Community Radio Network.
Here on Well, 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 we delve into the issues impacting and surrounding the health and well-being of our gender, sex and sexually diverse communities. I'm your host, Jack Ranjanan, coming to you from Joy's Victorian Pride Centre on Boonwurrung Country, but not for long. Michael and Jacinta will be with you in just a moment, speaking about Hue, Colour the Conversation, which is an anti-oppression and anti-racism training and consulting group. Hue works to empower people and organisations with practical skills to challenge the root causes of racism and oppression. This episode will be joined by Elsa Tewitt-Rosenberg, the co-founder and director of Hue. That's coming up this episode on Well, Well, Well.
You're getting Well, Well, Well with the team from Thorn Harbour Health.
Hue Colour the Conversation is an anti-oppression and anti-racism training and consulting group, and they work to empower people and organisations with practical skills to challenge the root causes of racism and oppression. Elsa Tewitt-Rosenberg is a co-founder and director of Hue and joins us now in the studio. Welcome, Elsa.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being with us. Would you like to introduce yourself and tell us about how you're involved at Hue Colour the Conversation?
Yeah, sure. So my name's Elsa. My pronouns are she and they. I'm one of the co-founders and directors of Hue. I'm a facilitator, a performer, an organizer, and got involved with, well, launched Hue a couple of years ago with my co-founder, Sonia. A lot of the stuff that I do with the organization is a lot of facilitation of our workshops, some consulting stuff, and lots of working with the community.
And how did Hue kind of start? You said it kind of launched a few years ago. Was it the result of a project that was kind of developed and launched through COVID lockdowns, or how did it kind of come into fruition, I guess?
Yeah, so myself and Sonia actually met at an organization called Democracy in Color, which are an amazing people of color-led racial and economic justice organization. They do a lot of campaigning and organizing. Both of us were volunteering there. Sonia was the director of community organizing, and I actually launched the training and education program there. But that was more than a couple of years ago now, it was like three years ago now, that time really flies. But both Sonia and I, outside of Democracy in Colour, have a background in working at organisations, most of which are racist. I would be more specific around what kinds of organisations, but I think basically for anyone who has ever worked at a workplace, you will probably find that workplace is racist in some way. And so both of us were working in the kind of social change space, which I think for many of us who have marginalized experiences, we kind of expect that those spaces are going to be safe havens for us, or that we are finally going to be in a place where we are understood or that's values aligned. And unfortunately, many of us have a bit of a rude awakening when we get there, and we find that a lot of the harmful systems that we see around us every day are replicated even in those organizations. So for us, the creation of Hue was born out of those experiences and sort of thinking about, okay, well, if this is even what the social change sector looks like, what do we want the social change sector to know and understand about the experiences of people of color and about systemic racism, to actually start changing the ways that they do things, changing their attitude, changing their strategy, their processes, their ways of working, their policies. And it was from the desire, I guess, to be able to feel safe in a workplace that we ended up creating Hue and launching our training program. As I said, it started under Democracy in Colour, but pretty quickly, you know, when we started this program, there was the peak of the media coverage of the Black Lives Matter movement, which motivated a lot of people who hadn't thought about racism before to start tackling it. And we just started seeing a huge amount of need and demand for education around racism. And really quickly, you know, we had a pretty humble dream, I would say, which would be to pay ourselves for this work, recognize that this is meaningful and genuine work, not just work that people of color should have to do on top of the work that they already do in their job descriptions at their current job, which is what many marginalized people experience. And, you know, not only were we able to do that, but when we launched Hue, we ended up creating a team of 6 people of color to do this work. So, yeah, that's a bit where we came from.
And this is a really massive question, but what kind of impacts does racism have on people's health and well-being? Do you see any patterns in the discussions and the stories that are shared in the Hue sessions?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But I mean, I think that racism impacts everybody. It impacts people of color, it impacts white people, it disproportionately, of course, impacts First Nations people and people of color as a result of colonization. But the impacts of racism really seep into all of our psyches, you know. Something I like to say is, even, you know, for people who are, you know, not people of color, but that have curly hair, for example, and who maybe have that experience of wanting to straighten their hair or being told in a workplace that it's more professional to have straight hair, congratulations, you've experienced a taste of anti-blackness, right? Because that's where that kind of discrimination comes from. And ultimately, all of us are impacted by racism and colonialism. When we think about how our climate is changing, you know, that is a direct result of colonialism. When we think about grind and hustle culture and how burnt out everyone is, that's a product of capitalism and colonialism, which is on this land rooted in racism. So yeah, there's really no one who goes unscathed by these really harmful systems, which, you know, is why we are so invested in our kind of collective liberation from these racist systems too, because unfortunately it's not just the impact of, you know, being at the receiving end of a slur or discrimination or bullying as a result of racism, although those experiences are really true and real. It's just something that ultimately really impacts all of us and requires all of our investment as a result of that.
Yeah. Also, Hue's website says that the usual approach of, you know, check the box, diversity and inclusion training is ineffective and pursues professionalism and politeness rather than actually building real change. How does Hue's approach to training support a different understanding of anti-racism and anti-oppression?
So I think ours is different because we focus on the systems that are at play. Many diversity and inclusion programs that have been run for a long time are run by white people, with people without actual lived experience of racism. And yeah, it's much more about what you can and can't say rather than actually looking at the systemic issues and injustices, looking at critical thinking skills and reflection. And I think that's where our work workshops really differ, because also we don't do a presentation. You know, it's not like we have a PowerPoint and we just give you a lecture about the information. We generally work with whole teams. We bring them in, we ask them questions about what their understandings of racism are, and then we build on those learnings through facilitated conversations. So these workshops are really highly participatory. They're really engaging, which means that the learning actually sticks with you. Also, because you're developing those understandings with your team and your peers, and you're learning from the people around you, that learning is actually going to be more robust. It's going to stick in your brain for longer, and you know that you actually have some of these shared understandings with your colleagues and the people who are actually going to be able to hold you accountable to the things that you're learning, or to be able to reflect on future actions or behavior and go, oh, okay, how does this tie in? How does this policy I've just come across, you know, relate to that thing that we learned in the workshop? I think we're also different because we don't shy away from tough conversations. I think that often when conversations are had about diversity and inclusion, there are a lot of buzzwords that get thrown around. I don't know if any of you have ever been in a meeting where sometimes I end up in meetings with other organizations and I just don't even know what anyone is saying. It's just like platitude after buzzword after buzzword. And, you know, there's no real tangible movement. People are dancing around the things that really need to be said. And for us, we don't do that, you know. It's not about putting people offside, and obviously we're really mindful to hold people's feelings and not let people just slip too much into defensiveness. You know, I think we do it in a gentle way, but we're also honest, you know. It's just about saying things how they are and speaking truth to power in a lot of cases, and bringing everyone along on a journey where we can all understand our history and our present and all the context that is wrapped up in these racist systems together.
Yeah, powerful work that you're doing. It's really fantastic to hear. Absolutely. Someone addressing the issues head on rather than, like you said, dancing around things. Because I think even in the sectors that we're in where we're trying to make change and we're working with community, and for us, it's, you know, about lived experience as well and peer-to-peer work. But yeah, to be able to actually have those uncomfortable conversations is really important to get things happening. And yeah, hats off to you and the team at Hue, because I've attended that training and it's so incredibly moving and actually useful.
Oh, thank you. I'm humbled that you've come along.
Yeah. We'll be back with Elsa in just a moment. Stick with us on Well, Well, Well.
Sexual health, mental health, and the overall well-being of our LGBTIQ communities. You're listening to Well, Well, Well.
You're with Michael and Jacinta on Well, Well, Well. We're continuing our conversation with Elsa from Hue Colour the Conversation, which is an anti-oppression and anti-racism training consultant group. Elsa, we wanted to pick up the conversation about First Nations people and people of colour have the pressure to educate and create change in organisations and workplaces, alluding to what you were saying before, often in an unpaid and unsupported capacity, particularly when those people are the minority within their organization. They might be wearing multiple hats. What impact does this have on these individuals?
Oh my gosh, it's so exhausting. I think it's, aside from just being so, so, so tiring, I think it also really can eat away at your boundaries and at your self-worth in a way, because I think for a lot of people in this position, you know, you sort of feel like it's your obligation or your responsibility, or you're not being a good enough community member, or you're not taking enough action if you don't kind of sacrifice yourself in your workplace to make that kind of change. And even though, you know, it can be, I really recognize the noble intentions of many First Nations people and people of color who are doing that, and recognize that for many of us, we don't even have a choice. You know, we get put in the organization and we're tokenized from the second that we get there, and that our worth is kind of pinned to the amount of extra labor we do around anti-racism work or whatever justice work is related to your lived experience. You know, I really recognize that. But also for many of us, we just end up crossing our own boundaries over and over and over again. We get extra pieces of work added to our workload that our white peers don't get added to their workload. And often we don't get paid for that extra time, for that extra piece of work, for that knowledge and expertise as well. You know, often organizations don't recognize that community knowledge and lived experience is a legitimate form of knowledge and expertise. You know, we have a culture that's so obsessed with objectivity and, you know, researching things and keeping things at arm's length. And we believe that people are somehow more of an authority to speak on something that they've researched rather than something that they've experienced. But, you know, for people of color, so many of us draw our knowledge from that lived experience. And not only is it an amazing form of knowledge and expertise, but it's also our trauma, you know? And when you are drawing on that knowledge base every day for work that you didn't necessarily sign up for and that you're not getting paid for, I mean, I guess you can only imagine how frustrating and exhausting that must be after a long period of time, especially.
Mm. And who offers people of color only sessions as part of the work that you do? Obviously, all of that is something that I assume is discussed in those kinds of sessions, but are there any kind of key benefits that you get from having that separate person of color only space?
Totally. Well, I think the thing is that even as people of color, all of us have different levels of knowledge and levels of access to information about systemic racism and how those systems have impacted our lives. I think it's important not to assume that just by virtue of having that identity, you have had access to that kind of learning or information. But for us, you know, we might digest those things in different ways. So for example, in one of our programs that's specifically for people of color, we talk about internalized racism. You know, what does it look like to internalize these ideas, these systems, and these beliefs, and how does that shape how we navigate the world, how we present ourselves, what kind of personality we show people, how we might code switch or interact in our organization versus with our friends or our families. And then we also talk about lots of ways that we can resist racism that don't hurt and harm ourselves, essentially. So looking at things like boundaries, looking at rest, looking at joy, looking at healing, all these really important liberatory practices that often get pushed to the side, and particularly for people of color. So yeah, I think it's really important for organizations to not only be looking at how they can enlighten their white staff about racism, but to also look at what supportive strategies they have for the people of color on their team as well.
Yeah. Thinking about organizations doing work and projects and stuff outside of, you know, developing that cultural safety at a worker level, does Hugh offer consultation as well? And if so, what does that look like and what does that involve?
Yeah, absolutely, we do. And it looks like a whole bunch of different things. You know, it can be from looking at culture audits of your organization, seeing what the experiences are of different staff who have different lived experiences and how they might give you an insight or picture into the structures or harmful culture that exists in your organization. We do consulting on things like comms and marketing strategies to make sure that they're not falling into kind of racist or harmful, problematic tropes. But, you know, I also have had someone get in touch who says, hey, I'm a white person and I'm in a relationship with a person of color. I would really like some individual support and coaching on how to be a better support for my partner. Or I had someone who is writing a book, actually, and the character is a Chinese and Jewish person. And they reached out to us and said, you know, do you have someone with this lived experience on the team who can, you know, inform the book that I'm writing, which was a really fun project to be a part of. So I think consulting can look like a whole range of things. There's, you know, the more kind of organizational process side. And then there's also just how we relate to each other in the world side, which I think is equally as valuable and important.
Yeah. And particularly those kinds of things important to, just speaking on behalf of our organization, the work that we do when we're thinking about running campaigns that support the health and well-being of, you know, people from different backgrounds and experiences, making sure that when we're centering, say, you know, a Vietnamese Australian person in a using photography in a campaign, making sure that we're doing it authentically and we're showcasing that person's cultural identity respectfully and not imparting our own whiteness onto that person's experience. I think that's really important kinds of work that I think can probably be done in that space. Diverting slightly, if there's a serious incident of, you know, racism in a workplace or movement, what can be done to address this in the wider organization? And I guess that is also relevant to, for instance, when you're running a workshop, if there's, you know, words used in a session when people are sharing their own experience that are harmful or impactful, how do you respond to that or navigate that space?
So I think that challenging an example of racism when it comes up actually starts way before that instance of racism happens. There are things that we can say in the moment. There are definitely ways that we can approach something that happens in the moment. You know, I often suggest or the tips that I like to use around confronting or challenging someone is to be empathetic, relatable, and humble, you know, when we have those conversations. But ultimately, it starts way before that moment, right? It's about creating an environment and a culture that firstly signals to people that you are dedicated to, you know, inclusive conversations and to having justice embedded in the work that you do. In a workplace environment, it's about maybe having policies that are supportive of staff if they experience discrimination, and it's about having training and education for the people on your team so that they have knowledge in advance of what kind of things might be harmful or how certain comments might tie into racist systems. It's about creating a culture of feedback, right, where people feel confident and comfortable with challenging people on their behavior because they know that it's going to be received warmly and with grace. So I think that, you know, developing skills for conflict, developing trusting relationships, all those things are the real work that comes before that racist incident happens. That racist incident is the product of a bunch of harmful systems and omissions in, you know, relationship, community building, trust building, education, etc. When it's in a workshop, you know, we hope that we have set up the conditions where people know that they might be challenged on their behavior, and people are told at the beginning of the workshop or even before the workshop what the expectations are in the workshop, you know, not to use slurs, for example, or even not to repeat stories that might trigger people or really impact other people in the space. But we also, you know, our facilitators are told that they can interrupt someone if they need to, they can end the conversation if they need to, and also recognizing the safety of our facilitators too is they can also end a workshop if they need to. We tend to say, you know, if the facilitator is feeling unsafe, other people are probably feeling unsafe as well. And we want to support our facilitators to check in with themselves and think about what their boundaries are as well. And if you're getting to a point where you're like, I don't want to have a conversation with this person, then they're well within their rights to end a workshop as well and keep themselves safe and protected in that situation.
We are steadfastly running out of time, but Elsa, I wanted to ask what advice, maybe briefly, you have for people of colour, First Nations people who are feeling isolated or unsupported in their workplace or movement?
Oh, so many things. I mean, I think it first would be connecting with community as often and as much as you can. And if those people aren't already accessible to you, to start working towards finding them, even if they're not in your workplace, finding community has been a lifesaver for so many people of color, I think, who have felt really isolated otherwise. But on top of that, I would say finding allies in your organization, finding people that you can trust, that you can rely on, people who are willing to stick their neck out for you as well, who can advocate for things that otherwise might put you in a more precarious position, or at least people who can back you or lend an ear or just some compassion and emotional space for you to vent if things are coming up. And finally, if you have the opportunity, like if it is possible for you, leave organizations that are asking too much of you. Often when we leave a situation, we can open ourselves up to opportunities that will serve us far more. And you deserve so much more than to be in an organization that is draining your life force. You know, give 30, 50% of yourself to your workplace, keep the rest to yourself, you know, maintain your peace at all costs where possible.
Yep. Fantastic advice, I think, and something that a lot of people out there are very much in need of being able to access that kind of advice and to know that support is out there and community is out there. I guess thank you so much, Elsa, for joining us today. It's been incredible talking to you. We will have Hugh's contact details up with the podcast on the website, so that if people want to get in touch with Hugh, maybe to book some sessions, all of those details are there. Can people reach you on socials or anywhere else as well?
Yeah, you can find us on Instagram at Colour the Conversation. I think we're on LinkedIn, but don't bother finding us there. It's really boring there. Find us on Instagram.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Elsa. We appreciate your time today.
No worries. Thanks so much for having me.
You're getting well, well, well with the team from Thorn Harbour Health.
That is it for the show this week. If you missed part of this episode, or you want to listen to any of our other episodes, you can find them on the Joy website, joy.org.au/well, well, well. And if you have any feedback or suggestions for topic discussions for us, you can let us know well, well, well@joy.org.au. But that is it for this episode. Thanks for joining us, and we'll catch you next time.
Thanks for listening to Well, 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 supported by Thorn Harbour Health on Joy and the Community Radio Network. For more LGBTIQ plus health and wellbeing and much more, check out Thorn Harbour on social media at Thorn Harbour or via the website thornharbour.org.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.